Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the China Startup Pulse, your looking glass into the Chinese and the Asian startup ecosystem, where we bring you the founders, the investors, and the shapers of the innovation ecosystem in the region. Today, we have Richard Brubaker, a sustainability expert that is the founder of Collective Responsibility and Hands on Shanghai, a charity that promotes sustainability among everybody in different parts of China. We're going to be talking about how China is a perfect place for sustainability startups, how Shanghai is an ideal market to take any product to the real consumer and to explore how to take that after to other parts of the world. Also, going to talk about how Elema is exploring new initiatives to reduce the impact of his success and how companies like Mobike and Ofo that successfully built a model in China that was exported to other markets are suffering here the impact of growth and success. I'm Oscar Ramos. I'm going to be your host for today, and welcome, Richard. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the China Startup Pulse. Today, we have Richard Brubaker, founder of Hands on Shanghai, a charity in China, a collective responsibility, a sustainability consulting company, and also an adjunct professor in CIPS Business School here in Shanghai. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Great. Richard has been in China for 16 years and a half. He came in the mid-90s to Japan, backpack around the region, and fall in love with it. Unfortunately, the financial crisis didn't allow him to get what he wanted in the region. So he went back to the US to work and get some training in an MBA. Mm-hmm. And that brought him back to Shanghai, where he was kind of tired of education. So after playing a lot of Chinese chess, he ended up in Shanghai, what he calls the most entrepreneurial city in China. What makes Shanghai special?
Well, it changed over time. So I've been here for 15 years now after SARS. So when I first came here, this was definitely, if you were entrepreneurial in any way, you want to be a hustler, you want to cut your own sheet, basically you had to be here. Beijing at the time, and this has changed significantly, but at the time you kind of had English teachers, you had Chinese students, and you had expats. And that middle ground, you know, the young professional gatherings, it was still very small because the sales offices were mainly down here, or at least there was a higher concentration. So when I came down here, for whatever reason, I wasn't even an entrepreneur when I came to China. I was looking for the big job, but I just felt more at home here with the other half-pats, as I call them. They were the people who are, you know, 28 to 40 years old, who are not looking for the big career, but were looking to be here for long term. And there was a much higher concentration I found here than there was in Beijing at the time. So that's what made it special when I moved here. What's kept it special is just the dynamic of the city and how it's constantly evolved and changed, and the people brings in, the opportunities that are provided through that, but also the lessons that we're learning here that we can apply to other cities in China. But more interesting for me is really what's happening in the Asia region, be it Bangkok, Jakarta, Singapore, KL, Hong Kong. Those cities are mirroring more closely to Shanghai than to, say, Beijing. So a lot of the systems that I play with, and we'll talk about that, I'm sure, be it waste or labor or whatever, they're learning from what's going on here more closely than what I see up in Beijing. So that's what's kind of kept it fresh for me. And oh yeah, it's always had better air. So that helped.
Good. Richard, you're now the sustainability guy here. Like, everybody in Shanghai knows you. That's what you share in SIB. That's what you do with your company. But you were not always in sustainability. You actually started your career in a totally different field.
Yeah.
And that was that practice in China what led you to kind of be more interested about that topic and see the opportunity. How did you get to the conclusion that it was a very important thing in China?
So the first part of my career in China was really helping firms enter China. So it could have been, you know, brands looking to develop retail. It could be banks trying to buy kind of default buildings. It could be manufacturers trying to get into the industrial parks. I had a big project where I was traveling around into China's second tier cities, the provincial capitals. And we were looking at basically buying hundreds of apartments was essentially the task. And which cities should we place bets into? And this is in 2000, between 4 and 7, when I was really engaged in that. But the peak was 2006 and 2007. So you imagine going to Chengdu back then. You know, if you bought 100 apartments in that city, you would change the real estate market. It was that small. But what you could see was just cranes and people and resources and all this stuff coming into the city from outside. And I just kept going, how can we make this work? When you have 32 provincial capitals, when you have third and fourth tier cities all going through the exact same process, How does that work? I'm not worried about solar panels and polar bears from sustainability. It's really about, for me, this is where China gets really interesting, is that I look at 2050, 7 billion urban residents. How do we successfully support them in an economy that provides jobs, that provides food, that provides access to healthcare, education, like everything that people come to a city for? How do you do that? And that was a question really born through my experience in China, traveling around. There's a lot of expectations. There's a lot of demand to meet those expectations. But how are we actually going to physically do it from a supply chain, from an environment, and everything considered? So that's where it got kind of really interesting for me. And that's kind of how I got my start in sustainability. That was then catalyzed by the Sichuan earthquake. I already had my charity where I was managing volunteers in the city of Shanghai. But after the earthquake, it really, I was kind of catalyzed to widen that. So we opened up an office in Chengdu. We helped build a couple community centers. We started building a volunteer platform there. So I always had like that social side. And that was matched to my business side. And around that time, I just kind of flipped. I was like, this is, I want to do something different. I want to look at sustainability as a business model and help companies do that. So that was...
You already mentioned that that some of the patterns that you see in Shanghai are the patterns that are now being followed, yeah. The models that are being followed by other cities in Asia. How much this China model of sustainability is relevant for the rest of the world?
Oh, very. So if I think about the waste research that we've recently done, the informal sector, the trash pickers that are happening, that, you know, I saw a study from Beijing that was something like 300,000 people are involved in the informal recycling system in Beijing. I'm assuming Shanghai's on similar scale. I see the exact same thing happening in Bangkok and in Jakarta and in KL and in other parts of the region. They're suffering from, I mean, they're just overwhelmed by the amount of waste that's being created by urban consumption. And unlike, say, in the West, very generic terms, there's no waste management system that can effectively capture all these wastes, which is why when you see the news that, you know, 89 or 92% of all ocean plastic comes from Asia. It's because the cities themselves haven't built that system of waste management into their cities at a pace that keeps up with the rise of urban consumption, but also the disposability that happens in this region. It's phenomenal. Plastic bags, one-use packaging, everything. It's at a much higher rate here than it is in other parts of the world. And that's in part because people are moving to the city so fast. These cities weren't planned, or the systems weren't keeping up with the fact that you had 300,000 people moving into them every year. I remember in Minhang District, when I first moved here, they had something in the order of like, say, 300 to 500,000 residents. When I had registered our charity down there in 2010, they had 2.5 million in the span of 6 to 8 years. I mean, the speed is just phenomenal. And that's a shared thing among all these cities. So if you're looking at quality, access of healthcare, education, affordable housing, same problem across the region. Lessons will be learned from here for sure. Waste, consumption, all these patterns. Because the main shift, it's not the Western lifestyle. It's the urban lifestyle. Once you move out of the farm into the city, everything changes.
Unresolved problems, a fast pace. Mm-hmm. That's the perfect ecosystem for entrepreneurs and for new startups to bloom.
Absolutely. Yeah.
What new things are you seeing in China in the space of sustainability?
Actually, it's quite a bit. And I think first off, you have to kind of disconnect yourself from the definition of the term sustainability. I look at some of the most interesting platforms around health tech, education technologies are here. Packaging, a lot of really interesting things happening there. This isn't cassava and things that you'd see like in Southeast Asia. This is more, you know, redesigning, repurposing, upcycling, those things. We just did a textile waste project for a large label, an athletic apparel company. And, you know, it's funny because when we first started, it's like, oh, you know, there's just no capacity to take all this apparel. It's just going to be thrown into the landfills or burned. And within a radius of, we'll call it 200 kilometers, maybe a little bit more, we found 50 different recycling facilities. And there's a whole range of the rainbow. But what was interesting was we found 2 to 3 led by entrepreneurs who put in the absolute top end equipment. They're losing money badly, but they realize that there's a way of doing this the right way. And that separated them. So actually the client that we were working with, we really kind of pushed them. We said, look, you're gonna have to pay a little bit more for them, but this is the right way to do it. So that, you know, if I look at food waste, we found an amazing guy up north of Shanghai who takes 60 tons a day of food waste and turns it into compost. He's totally off the books because there's no regulation allowing this, but he's doing it in partnership with the government in part to develop the standards. So he's really out far on the limb. He could lose everything, but he also realizes that this is a huge gap that cities have to meet. They're putting out far more food waste every day than they can manage. Solutions are going to come. And we saw 3 or 4 different things that are happening in each of these areas, health technologies, you know, Shingran, Martin Shun. I mean, he's just done amazing work, right? In part because he saw what the expectations were, and he himself had a personal interest in this, and he scaled up the business. Tons of opportunities. And the nice thing about Shanghai is if you can get it done in Shanghai, all the governments, all the city governments will come here, see what you're doing. And there's two ways of taking this. One is that you will then be invited over, or two, they'll start to replicate you. And if you're in the sustainability space, broad spectrum, copying is something that we should be promoting because we want to solve human problems. So if you're invited, great, and there's a great business model. But if not, at least you can pilot, show that can be done, and then the work can be done by others. And that's also a great thing.
So that's actually an interesting thing when you're talking about copying, because for a long, long time, China has been known as a place where copy to China was the business model,
yeah,
the main driver of things.
Yeah.
But this is changing right now, and there are actually industries where China is becoming a pioneer,
yeah,
and where actually the trend has been reversed, where China is becoming the inspiration for not just companies or entrepreneurs or other countries in Southeast Asia and other parts of Asia,
yeah,
but also in more developed economies like in Europe or in America.
Sure.
Do you think that this sector of sustainability, entrepreneurs are leading here a new trend of born in China innovation?
I think so, but I wouldn't necessarily say that's going to come from the Chinese population. I think it's going to come from anyone who lives in these cities, be you're native to China, or you are or native to Shanghai, or you're from outside Shanghai, but you're Chinese, or you're a foreigner like us coming in. I don't think it's about borders. I think it's about understanding the pain points that people feel in whatever context you can, building the product, building the team, and going from there. And anyone who can successfully do that, which we know is a really tough hill to climb, no matter where you come from, what your background is, and how good your funding is. But I think the beauty, in some sense, going back to my earlier comment, is that because Shanghai has grown so fast, the system's unable to keep up. So the failures are very visible. And immediately you have, like, say, it could be around labor, it could be around pigs in the river, it could be anything. The government, once there's an understanding that business as usual cannot continue, the media gets on board. The government gets on board, business gets on board, and everyone can kind of focus on that. If you're the entrepreneur in advance of that, the resources that come to you are phenomenal. And that's also something unique about China, is they have a significant amount of resources to solve these problems. They're willing to shut down tens of thousands of factories to clean the air. You don't get that many countries. You don't get that many cities. So if you're an entrepreneur and you read the map appropriately, it's going to be based on how you look at the city, the issue you want to solve, and how you map those pain points. But you just know what's going to happen. Like, we should know that they're going to have an energy crisis here at some point, a food crisis, a healthcare crisis, an educate. The question is, like, what is it going to be? How many people are impacted? And what are going to be the solutions to address that problem? If you put yourself ahead of that as an entrepreneur on your own or entrepreneurial inside of a company, there's a huge market for that.
I mean, I always talk with entrepreneurs that that when they come to China, they think about China as a massive market.
Yeah.
But one of the key things is that the Chinese consumers are also amazing early adopters,
mm-hmm,
and they are very, very forgiving with products that are half baked. So that's fundamental for any type of new innovation that will require iterations and experimentation and will have problems in the first versions. So it seems that this is what you're seeing. I mean,
thank you, because we launched an app a couple months ago and it didn't do as well as we thought it would. So I'm glad to know there's some forgiveness that I can cash in later.
No, it's amazing. It's amazing how much people here is ready to try new things and give a second chance. I mean, there's other markets where products get like forgot.
Yeah.
And here you have that opportunity of a second chance that makes China also an interesting lab for new things. So you feel that that in this, for founders working in sustainability products or projects, Shanghai could be that perfect lab where you have a sizable market, like 30 million people, massive city, that then you can replicate anywhere in the world.
So yes and no. And I think it depends upon also the segment or the problem you're trying to solve. In part because if you think, like, you can't really fuck up healthcare. You can't really fuck up food safety. Like, you're not going to get second chances on those. But if you're talking about, like, say, you know, more like the lifestyle movements, if you don't launch your app, you don't launch your product perfectly, and you're iterating through the community, I think you can do that. Our app is focused on left behind children. And I know that, like, with that community, we're tied into the parents quite well. You know, my team is just, you know, constant communication with them and learning and asking them and measuring and how can we make improvements? And actually, we're kind of 3 months into it now. We're trying to figure, like, okay, what are the adjustments we need to make? I think for that specific product, there's probably quite a bit of forgiveness. But if this was a healthcare app, I don't know. Like, I think part of the reason why people come to your solution is because there's so much imperfection in the current process that's causing a significant amount of pain. They want to come to you and they want to trust you. So I think it really depends upon product and who you're working with and what their pain point is that you're trying to solve.
I want to change now and move from the startups that are trying to capture that opportunity in the sustainability space and talk about big startups and how sustainability is something that could potentially impact their industry. Yeah. So everybody's talking about the growth of e-commerce in China and how e-commerce is making retail, traditional retail, suffer, and how it's also enabling access to lots of people to products and services and things that in the past they couldn't even dream about because it was like just having access to that was very difficult.
Yeah.
But how sustainable is that?
I think some very unsustainable parts to it. And I also think about like, how do you want to frame sustainability? Like, you know, a lot of the food deliveries, their main two or three points are one, we offer access to more than you could have if you were to, like for lunch. We offer you access to restaurants from all over the city. You don't have that. We save you time. The food comes to you and it's cheaper. So, okay, you provide those. Great. What about the plastic bags? What about the plastic lids? What about all these waste streams that we've now created? You know, if I look at, say, e-commerce, Amazon or, you know, Taobao, we've gone from retail packaging, which would be, say, you know, you would send one master pack to one retail store of one product, and that master pack could then be reused multiple times. We are now taking a box of shoes. We're putting another box around it. We're sending a single item out to the market to each individual person. So we're ramping up waste on massive scale. And that, I think, is something most people don't really fully appreciate yet. I think we're starting to get there, though. I think like through coffee cups and plastic straws, there's some recognition that the way that we've changed from, you know, going to restaurants and eating on plates and with forks and that could be washed in the back to eating at our tables and, you know, in one use, there's some real awareness coming around that. But I think when the entrepreneurs first came up with these models, I don't believe that they thought through this problem. I don't think they cared. And that's not an intention. That's not a judgment of them as individuals. They were focused on addressing and delivering to a market something that was needed, and it just took off. The only thing that I think is going to be really interesting is going back to the cost function. It's only cheaper right now because these companies subsidize every purchase. What happens when that goes away? Will it still be cheaper to have your salad delivered to your table? And then when regulations come around, food packaging, how is that going to change the dynamic? It's already starting to happen, not just in Shanghai, but in other cities and countries around the world. We're going to have to start repricing our services and our assets or our resources. And that may fundamentally undermine some of their business models. So I think it's going to be really interesting. I think, you know, be it Mobike, the bike sharing systems, be it e-commerce, you know, your shoes, or be it, you know, your food delivery, the environmental impact of those, one, was never understood up front. It's only now being talked about, and the solution is going to get harder as they go along.
So a couple of weeks ago, Eluma announced that they were going to create Eluma Labs, a new organization under their brand. Eluma is the largest food delivery company right now in China.
Yep.
Received very big investment and process of acquisition by Alibaba, like also a really big giant here in the space. They launched this lab where they were trying to find a way to reduce the impact of sustainability. Mm-hmm. But this is the first initiative, one of the first initiatives that I heard about. Are you aware of these companies, not just like the general public, being aware of that problem, or these companies that they launch a business and, of course, I mean, the first problem that they have is like, does anybody actually want this? Can I do it? Yeah. And they're now in a process of, can I scale it and can I make it more sustainable? No, it seems that at least Eluma is considering this impact of sustainability, not just from can this exist forever, but also the ways, the different types of negative impacts.
So I think it really depends upon the company and the industry that they're in. There's definitely fear that if you ask consumers to pay more, that your growth numbers will start to come down or that you'll lose to your competition. But then what does leadership mean at the end of the day? Like what's Jack Ma, how many billions does that guy need before he starts to say, I can give up 5% of my wealth to deliver a higher environmental quality to the market? Like what's the numbers? We're always chasing these profit margins. What if you were just a much better company with a little bit less profitability that had higher consumer loyalty, had better relationships with your vendors, so you delivered on time, you delivered a better quality? Like, why don't we look at the actual business and how to improve that as a whole? And sustainability is part of that. Now, of course, I know there's plenty of people here who be like, oh, shut up. You know, like that doesn't make any sense. Of course, we'll lose growth. And I think when we're being fueled by investors whose return rates, they have those demands. So you also need to get into that. You need to talk to your investors as well. So it's just multifaceted. So when you go back to the Olema Labs, you know, they're not the only ones that are doing this. I'm really happy to see that companies are developing, they're actually putting physical, tangible resources. They're deploying them to see what can happen. But I kind of go back to the Starbucks and to a lot of other announcements that we've seen. They're announcements. Until I actually start seeing actual product, actual change in process, people, or product, it's not even worth really spending much time on in terms of like celebrating. We should be working right now, because I don't care if you're going from 100% non-recyclable to 75% recyclable. We're still scaling the overall supply of this into the environment at a much faster rate than we're reducing the impact itself. So per capita, per unit, yeah, that might be coming down. But the macro level, it's still going up. Mother Nature doesn't care about, you know, that denominator. All it cares about is that big number. So we need firms to make real adjustments. And I think that's going to come. The question is going to become, is it push or pull? Will it be governments who force you and say, in your retail stores, you can only deliver, you know, food in reusable containers. You can no longer, like, go to McDonald's or Starbucks or whatever. You're not allowed to use paper at all in your stores anymore. Or will it come from consumers saying, I don't want that straw. I don't need that coffee cup condom thing. Like, where's it going to come from? And can they drive consumer loyalty out of it? I'm much more interested in what you can do to align to the consumers and drive that than I am worried about rules and regulations. And I kind of wish that more firms would see it that way, because I don't think long-term it's a lose. But if you're in an industry where you're totally subsidized and reliant upon investors to even make your business model work, I don't know the sustainability of that either. I mean, one of these bike companies, most of them are going to die anyway. So why create so much waste in the middle? Like, just try and develop a better product.
Actually, that's a really good point, because probably these bike sharing companies, Mobike, Ofo, and other multiple brands, were probably one of the first Chinese models of startups that were copied in lots of different countries. And they were originally praised as a company that was really promoting sustainability, reducing the pollution, the need for transportation, etc. But in here, where we have a huge development of those companies that are basically everywhere, mm-hmm. we're starting to see the impact of the growth without any type of control, or with the growth with any type of thoughts about sustainability. So I know you've been doing some research on that, and you have some thoughts about the different strategies that companies have been using here.
Well, I think the original story around, I mean, I knew Mobike first because it was Shanghai. And I was a huge fan. So what I liked about it was that, it pulled people out of cars, it pulled people off buses, it got them out, and what you saw wasn't just, say, a reduction in emissions or an improvement in traffic. It was also the city felt more livable. And for me, I look at sustainability of cities as also like one of the main things you have to have is a quality of life. And I think that when you're out with your friends and you're mobiking around and you're taking pictures, like, you are part of the city. Right? Whatever street you go down, you're building a relationship somehow to that part of the city. And I always really like that about when you take people out of, you know, vehicles and put them on bikes. I really like that as a start point. Where it became a problem was when they decided to produce 100 million bikes that cannot be resold, cannot be reallocated, cannot be reused. They can only be scrapped. And this is where the whole environmental argument for this thing just falls apart. They're creating industrial waste on a scale that is just unfathomable right now. Like, you take these drone shots of these mountains of bikes that are still usable, but because of accounting, they can't be brought back into the system. It's waste. And anyone who tries to defend it, it's only because they have a vested interest in protecting their business. And that's the way I look at it. Like, I still like the fact that bikes are used, but I would heavily disagree with any numbers that they have around 8 trips per day for the average bike, considering that probably a good 10 to 20% of their bikes are in landfills, or not landfills, but are in these mountains. That means that the average bike right now on the street has to be used like 15 times. And we know that's not true. So I think the intent was a good start. But when the investors, when the market, when the hype came in, it just lost that original idea. And I knew some of the Mobike founders. I knew, like, they got into this, not entirely, but in part because they viewed it as a sustainable mode of transportation. And that's great. And then everyone kind of, copied it. The one thing, the one defense I'll give of Mobike over others is that their GPS functionality really, I think, gave them a leg up in this argument. You can see where the bikes are going. You can see where the bikes are. So, and they had early on kind of set up these social credits. So if you park it here, you get 1 point. If you don't, if you park in the middle of the street, you get downgraded. But, you know, the other bike companies didn't have that. So that's where you started seeing like bikes in the middle of the street, but you didn't see OAF or Mobike at the time. I'm sure there's always anecdotes. There's always people who disagree, but it was always like the other colors that were just strewn everywhere. And I think that got into the social sustainability of things. I mean, you walk around the city and you see like no bike parking here because the communities have been so heavily impacted by these bikes. And also they stand out that are just flashy, right? So I think, you know, it's how do you want to frame it? I do think it took people out of cars. Great. Huge, you know, 3 stars on that one. But the other downside, we should be debating that. We should be debating the waste function. We should be debating the impact to communities. We should be debating the reusability as a whole kind of life cycle analysis.
Richard, that's an amazing, absolutely new perspective for a lot of people to give a different vision about the world of startups and the growing pains of building a company. I mean, we talked about the problem of e-commerce and over-packaging, but that's something that is really deep into the industry here and how brands like Elema, they've already tried to create their own initiatives to solve that. What type of new things are you seeing there on that specific packaging issue?
So a lot of what we've seen with Elema or Starbucks, it's announcements so far. And there's pilots that are starting. And I'm actually pretty excited to see what comes out of it. But at this point, I would say nothing's come out of it. However, the innovations I'm seeing in general that are trying to address that problem come down to the materials of packaging. You know, do you want to use bio-based plastics, cassavas, things like that, to create new materials that when they go into the waste stream, they disappear? Also seeing a lot of people talking about process. How can we take back the materials? How can we upcycle the materials? Seen several shops in Shanghai, but also in the wider region of Shanghai, where they're just setting up completely to take this waste. They kind of accept that consumers are going to be consumers and that they're not going to change. What they want to do is change how the waste itself is then taken and turned into a resource, into something new. So there's a group called Use Them, and I've also seen a few much larger organizations. They take denim from the factory, but also from consumers, and they upcycle it into different things. I've seen furniture come out of it. I've seen car insulation come out of it. I've seen vast number of kind of denim products, be fluffy toys or whatever, come out of it. And so for them at that level, which is still very small, they're able to start like really trial that process. And there's a willing market for it here. There's not really a regulation preventing it. It's too small for anyone to really kind of push back on them. So, and they're addressing a much larger issue that if they work it out at the technology level, at the kind of at the process level, they could probably take it to other cities, other markets.
And I mean, at the end of the day, you can have a market. I mean, China is very big. So for one of the beauties of this market is that almost for anything that you want to do, even a very small niche market, it might become actually a relevant market that allows you to pilot, to try new things and then take it to any other bigger market out there. But how do you see the trends of the consumer? Because at the end of the day, I mean, I have this battle in the office with plastic bottles, which like don't use plastic bottles if you need. And people look at me like, what are you talking about? It's just more comfortable. So how do you see the consumer being actually concerned about that and valuing that? Because when we're talking about food security and especially anything that involves babies, there's a huge opportunity there just because people is very, very aware of the problem and the consequences, and they want to avoid that. But when we're talking about a more something that is not directly impacting them, but maybe not at least directly, but in a second generation or like the whole group.
Yeah. So this is a really tough one. I think for a lot of our clients, particularly when they're brands, you know, athletic brands, food brands, if you want to do something sustainable, i.e. greener, better, whatever it may be, what I've always found in these projects is that you can do quite a bit until you reach customer experience, right? In quotes, customer experience. Don't mess with my customer experience. And that could be in the store. So like if you're looking at construction materials, don't try and do something with bamboo or, you know, use MDF, use, you know, products like fiberglass and acrylic where the images, the colors pop because that provides the best customer experience. Don't try and go to hemp and other native materials or natural materials and reduce that customer experience. If you're talking about Elema, the food delivery, if you're talking about car shared services, if you're talking about other things, plastic bag related, a lot of companies get hung up on that. And I know from, you know, from our experience, that's the thing you have to overcome. And that's also because I think many people, including myself, believe that customers at the end of the day are going to be driven by convenience and cost. That's why food took off. You know, food delivery, like I don't have to leave my desk and I can have whatever I want and I can go eat with my colleagues. I don't have to go walk outside. I don't have to worry about rain. I don't have to worry about heat. I don't have to worry about losing time. I can just whatever I want. And I can't get across the city to get my, you know, Sichuan food anyway. So I'm just going to bring it to me. Also, it's much cheaper. So as long as you have those two constraints, I think it's very difficult to expect consumers to do much on their own. The Ulema earlier, one of, I think, their first programs was to say, do not use disposable utensils. You could click, I don't want disposable utensils or napkins, things like that. My understanding is that that did pretty well, but not amazingly well, because at the end of the day, it's really up to the restaurants themselves. You know, their process in the restaurant is just like Starbucks in theirs. They're just going to put it all together because they don't want to have someone go, no, I need this. So for me, customers are going to be customers. What you have to figure out is how do you build a system around them so that the integrity of the entire system is maintained regardless of the consumer's choice. You can't take away choice from them. You just have to make it easier for them to make a better choice.
I mean, you had experience with projects across different countries.
Yeah.
Is China a place that is on par with in terms of consumer adoption or consumer flexibility to this type of a alteration of the user experience to try to make the whole process more sustainable? Is China on par? Is China more open? Is China more conservative?
So I think China has a much more interesting foundation. If you look at food and food waste, the Chinese traditionally didn't waste food. If you look at energy, they didn't waste energy that much. So, and that's in part because of the culture where food came from. But also if you think, you know, they went through a rationing system. A lot of, like my father and mother-in-law and anyone above them, they were all through kind of the rationing period of China. My wife still remembers her early years going to, you know, take coupons to get textile, take coupons to get water and food, like, or sorry, not water, but food and different things. So they had that mindset. They would bring dishes to banquets to take the food away. But that's kind of been lost in the last 15, 20 years because wealth came in. But one of the most interesting kind of things that we pulled out one time was we looked at pork consumption in China. It's gone from about 8 to 10 kilos in the 70s to about 30 on average per capita, 35, I think. And that's largely driven by urban consumption, which is somewhere in the 50s, 50 kilos per year. It went from 10 per year to 50 per year in the last 40 years. One year, they had a huge dip. And that's in part because the price of pork went up 30% because there was a disease that culled part of the herd. So what you can see is within the urban context, the minute that it costs more, they start to conserve. And so this is actually, for me, was actually a really interesting kind of study that says, you know, there are different foundations, but at the end of the day, unless cost comes in, or something better comes in, you can't get that action to happen.
But that's what happened with plastic bags. I mean, I still remember bags. 10 years ago, you went to a supermarket, you get like 4 or 5 plastic bags.
And that's what you'll see in Thailand now. Yeah.
Because the plastic bags were so low quality. Now you have to pay. Quality is better. You get one.
But this is the funny thing. We were talking to some people right after that band bag came out. And we'll call it 6 months after, because it's been about, it was, 2008, 10, I think, when that bag ban came out. Within a few months, they realized that the fruit bags, you know, the really cheap, clear ones, those went up like 60%. So people were basically taking those bags and then bagging. So it wasn't quite as good. But then also the other thing is the reusable bags that you use, you know, those have a footprint as well. So no one's really done the full thing. But it was really interesting to see how consumers will change so quickly. They'll adapt. And not always in the way that you expect that they will. So that's really important. If you're going to be an entrepreneur or you're going to be entrepreneurial or you're going to be thinking through these solutions, you really have to spend some time figuring out, like, what is it that you want consumers to do better? If sustainability is like the big thing, what do you want them to do? And then what might they do, right? Because sometimes we create a solution that creates new problems. So you kind of have to think through that in advance. And I think in China, you can see that speed, which is fantastic. It might take them a lot longer in other markets. But here you'll see the system go totally crazy in a matter of months, and you can adjust to that.
So that's really clear. I mean, there's so many opportunities for an entrepreneur that wants to do something in that particular space. But if you're working in any other sector and you want to consider sustainability in your user experience, in the core of your company, how can a founder start thinking about that?
Well, I also think that they need to bring it back to, like, what is the problem that they're, as a company, trying to solve? So if you're in the healthcare space, you're in the education space, you're in the mobility space, there are industry-specific elements of broad-stroke sustainability. But at the end of the day, sustainability is really just about efficiency. It's about, you know, delivering using less materials at the same quality, the same convenience, the same cost, right? Like, you can look at your materials if you're a product group. How can you do better with less? It could be, how can you provide better to the market as well? So it also could be an internal thing. So at the end of the day, what it comes down to is, you know, what's your industry? What's the product or service you're delivering? You can look at this externally or internally. I think a lot of firms start internally. What can they do with their employees to improve, say, corporate social responsibility? That could be volunteering, philanthropy. You're not changing the world, but you're changing culture internally. Then how can you externalize that by looking at the product or service you're delivering and understand the wider context of sustainability in the market that you're in and map to something better? So if you're a food brand and you're delivering food from your store to someone's house, you've always had food safety concerns. Although, if you look at KFC, they read that map incorrectly. Big macro picture sustainability drove a very heightened awareness around food safety in their consumers. They had a question asked about antibiotics. They didn't exceed any standard. They didn't have a problem, but it didn't matter because the consumers expected much more. So they could have used this mindset of sustainability to understand what their consumers wanted at a much higher quality, a much higher level to see that map going forward. Food packaging. Everyone at this point, if you're in retail for food, you should know that the food packaging that you currently enjoy, it's for a short term, be it plastic bags, be it disposable cups, be it whatever that you have in your system that's disposable and could potentially in the landfill that becomes a problem for the government, whatever government you're in. They're going to start banning this stuff. They're going to start making you charge your consumers for it. You're going to have to find new materials for it. So you should really be actively thinking. Starbucks has been doing that for sure, but other brands are looking at it differently. But if you just think like, oh, nothing's going to actually change, and all of a sudden you have that regulation come in and you have no answer for it, we're already seeing that in the market here in Shanghai, which for an entrepreneur is a great thing because then you can start to, you know, bring your cornstarch boxes. You can start looking at, hey, we've engaged customers in this way. You know, you should use our process. And I think that's where things get really interesting. So I would say like any physical material, any physical product company, you should use sustainability. Think of it, just call it supply chain management. At the end of the day, like on the back end of your product, it's supply chain management. Reduce the waste, but also improve the materials. That's two very quick ways. I mean, I say quick, that's not very quick, but those are the two things that you could look at. You know, if you're using plastic, what's an alternative? If you're using cement, what's an alternative? If you're using acrylic, what's an alternative? But also, how can you deliver the same product with less materials? How can you thin out the plastic? How can you, you know, reduce the packaging, but still deliver customer experience? You can just start with those things. If you're service-based, then it's going to be obviously different. But lean in that context, it also applies to how you deliver your services, right? So then you have to figure out how to engage the consumers. So I actually, you know, for many of our products or projects that we look at, sustainability is just a switch for supply chain management, right? The same principles often largely apply.
Okay. So last thing you want to ask. Mm. A lot of our listeners, they are interested in China,
yeah,
but they are not in China.
Right.
They're foreigners. So yeah, there are certain industries in China where being a foreigner is a disadvantage. Mm-hmm. It's more difficult, get access to the resources, understanding really what are the different players, and even build relationships with those mm-hmm. players. In the space of sustainability, what are the areas where a foreign company or a foreign entrepreneur mm-hmm. could have an edge?
Anything that touches the physical body of their consumers, for sure. So food, healthcare, education. I think are three areas that if I were going to say you should start tomorrow, or you have the best opportunity, those would be three areas. Because it's been shown that Chinese consumers will pay a premium for those markets to a foreign brand. Could be milk powder, could be organics, could be iTalkI. Like they're paying premiums for these products and these services. That's on the consumer side. On the B2B side, it's a little bit more difficult. But I also think that that's where your technology comes in. If you have a much better technology than what's here natively, you will have a market for a period of time. Of course, your Chinese consumer is going to catch up. But I think, yeah, I mean, food, healthcare, education, big three. Anything that's intangible, like you have to explain too much, then you're not at an advantage. You know, your Chinese competitors can play with that value proposition because it's not clear enough. But food is super clear. Healthcare is super clear. Education is super clear. And there's other markets as well, which leads me to kind of like a more broad stroke. One thing I like about being a foreigner sometimes here is that you see things in stark contrasts. Everything is foreign to you. But if you use a context of where you came from, be it LA, New York, London, Geneva, whatever, you know, you saw how your city, your country adapted or overcame a challenge of sustainability, be it waste or healthcare or whatever. You can see that it's not happening here. And that might spark your idea where your Chinese peer may not understand that that gap exists because they're used to the system. Maybe they're happy with it for now. But you're like, well, no, actually, we saw this before, and at some point it changes, and when it changes, it looks like this. And as a foreigner, I think that sometimes you're set up for that a little bit differently, maybe sometimes easier. Then you have to work out the business. Then you have to work out the value proposition. But I think sometimes just the fact that everything is not native to you is an advantage as well. But of course, you have to build a team, build a product, cash flow, all that.
Good. So if anybody wants to get involved into any of your charities, involved for promotion of these sustainability projects, or they have a company and they want to explore, how can they be more sustainable? How can they change the way they operate? How can they contact you?
Well, I guess you can just Google me. Unless you're in China, then you can't. So Rich Brubaker, all my handles are that. My sustainability agency is coresponsibility.com. The charity, if you're in Shanghai, is hands-on-shanghai.org. And if you want to go to CEIBS, it's CEIBS.edu. And yeah, I mean, I think that when it comes to becoming a sustainable entrepreneur, you know, don't look to put that moniker on it. Really just figure out, like, what's a human need that you want to solve? What's an urban need that you want to solve? And how can you better allocate resources? How can you do it in a way that's more efficient, more mindful of the resources that we have, but also of the waste streams that are required longer term? Give real thought to it. And then I think that no matter what company you're in, be it tech or physical, whatever it is, you can make huge improvements.
Thank you, Richard.
Hey everyone, I just want to take a quick moment to thank our sponsor, China Accelerator. They are an accelerator based in Shanghai, bringing international ideas into China and Chinese ideas international. They're number one in what they do. They're a three-month program, and they help build your idea and make it amazingly successful. You can find out more at www.chinaaccelerator.com. People Squared is the original co-working space in China. It's your home for startups, no matter what you're working on. Small team or large, it has all the resources, the environment, the culture, everything that you need to take your idea and make it successful. Founded by Bob Zheng, an entrepreneur himself who really understands what startups need, it's a great place to bring your team and find success. You can find out more at people-squared.com.